The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Okay. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
Yeah.
Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. And once she grabs, she won't let go. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
None of that soft stuff.
Rock, rock.
None of that heavy metal stuff.
Rock, rock, rock,
just a little bit of jazz.
Rock, 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 and,
and a little bit of disco today.
What do you think?
Just I
like
love
that.
It.
We're going to start with a song because the times demand it.
Big laughs out in the hall.
At first we were afraid, we were petrified, kept hearing all about a red wave wiping out our side. But then returns started to come in, sparing us a ton of grief, and we relaxed and breathed a big sigh of relief. So screw the polls and all their claims. We saw those Trump-selected candidates go down in flames. They should have seen dramatic wins like other midterms tend to go. But it seems women and young voters told the GOP how no. We may not know for a while it's true. Votes being counted still, and there's that Georgia runoff too. Though to control of Congress we might say goodbye if there was no red wave. And it turns out Trump's the reason why. We will go on. We will survive. And as long as we stay strong, democracy will stay alive. We've got obstacles like gerrymandering, voter suppression, and more. But we know what's right, and we know what we're fighting for. We had big wins, perhaps none better than seeing that con man Oz defeated by John Fetterman. We won state legislatures, governors, and secretaries of state. And it turns out the turnout from young people was great. Abortion rights will stay protected. So overall, it was much better than expected. And after all these big historic votes, Trump and DeSantis are already at each other's throats.
Oh, yeah.
So tweet, insult, and shout. Woo! Let the fights begin as we all get our popcorn out.
Mm-hmm.
Weren't you the ones who tried to take our rights away? You couldn't do it. So you can all eat through the tail. We're not done. We will survive. Cause as long as we're allowed to vote, we've got the drive. I can't believe folks voted for so many idiots, right? But we will fight, and we will thrive, and we'll survive. We will survive. Democracy and reproductive rights will stay alive.
Oh, yeah. We will survive. Lauren Mayer, everybody. We will survive. Finally. Yeah. Sorry. Let the applause play out. Lauren Mayer, everyone. Find her at Lauren's Comedy on the YouTubes, of course, on Twitter and all the other places. Lauren Mayer. And a perfect song to kick off this new week because we are surviving. You know what? Screw the polls. And let me just tell you, you can't believe anything. You know how we've been told for the better part of the last 2 years how Joe Biden's approval ratings were in the toilet. I don't think we can trust that. The media, who runs most of these polls anyway, they want a horse race. And this one wasn't a whole lot of a horse race, except for what the media, you know, ginned up during the many months leading up to the end of the election. So anyway, go figure. We have a lot to celebrate. The numbers over the weekend came trickling in so that, well, we know that the Democrats will control the Senate in the 118th Congress. Hell yeah. And that is whether or not Raphael Warnock wins in the Georgia runoff that's happening December 6th. I hope he does, because I can't fathom the idea of Herschel Walker in the Senate. Really? But also, look, this deadens the enthusiasm for the Republicans to come out and vote, because even if they elect the brain damaged football player, it's not going to make a difference in terms of which party controls the Senate. If for some reason Georgia goes to the Republican, and I just can't see it happening, well, then it's like we have now. It'll be 50-50, and Kamala Harris will be the tiebreaker. But if Raphael Warnock wins, as he should, it'll be 51-49, which will render one half of Manchinima impotent. And I don't care which half it is. Maybe we can get half of each. But, you know, we're in the right, going in the right direction. So a lot still, the one thing still, well, there's the Georgia race. There are a few California House races that will determine the fate of the House, which party will control it. We still don't know, and we likely won't know for a while. But that's okay. We can be patient, right? Patience is a virtue. And what else? There's the Arizona governor's race. And Katie Hobbs is still in the lead. Make no mistake, Katie Hobbs will win this one. The latest is they've got 98% of the vote in, and Katie Hobbs is still up by over a point over her opponent, if you can call Carrie Lake that. So I am choosing to remain optimistic. We have a lot of good reasons to remain optimistic. Things are looking pretty good. But here's what I was thinking. It's been a while. For like the last month, we've been so entrenched in the elections that, frankly, I have let my my coverage of the other news that's going on sort of lack for something. So you know what the remedy for that is, don't you? Of course you do. It's a Monday with Marcy. Oh, yeah. Marcy Wheeler and Katie Porter, too. She's doing okay. She'll be okay. But, Katie Porter. So I'll tell you what. We've got Marcy Wheeler. She joined me this morning because, you know, Marcy lives in Ireland these days. So it's more convenient for her to tape in the morning here, which is afternoon there. So we will go to the videotape. And then on the back end, we should have a couple of minutes anyway, and I'll go over the latest numbers with you on some of those outstanding races, like the Arizona governor, like Katie Porter, and a few others, okay? But now, with no further ado, my go-to person for all things national security and prosecuting the insurrectionists and the 9/11. Oh my God, brain fart. 1/6 commission and all that stuff. We go to Marcy Wheeler. You find her at emptywheel.net, and of course, on the Twitters at Empty Wheel, but now at Mastodon. But we'll get into all of that. So with no further ado, let's do it. All right, here we go again. Marcy Wheeler returns to the show. We've got some good news to talk about for a change, and some ongoing investigations. Marcy, how were you surprised by the election results?
I, in advance of the election, I think consistently said I didn't know what was going to happen, which I think was the appropriate approach to take because nobody did know. And guess what? We narrowly survived to fight another day again. So I think, what a relief.
Right. I mean, big time relief.
And I'm still a Michigan voter, and Michigan was probably easily the best state of any in the country. So I'm really thrilled about what happened in Michigan. But I think more generally, we live to fight another day.
That's it. I mean, I think Americans showed we're not ready to allow fascism take over again, and they fought back. And Joe Biden was right. You know, the speech he delivered on protecting democracy was an act
which no one covered.
Which no one covered. But was the right move to make.
If people had actually covered it.
Right. He took so much criticism for his strategy and everything. And I think Joe Biden is being vindicated across the board right now.
Yep. Yep. I mean, he his policies got youth out. His policies got women out. He was right that this was a fight for democracy. And guess what? Independents and a significant chunk of Republicans prefer democracy to the Trumpist fascism.
Go figure, right? There are still a few races we're waiting on, but the bottom line is the Democrats will control the Senate. The question: there are two races still outstanding. One is in Alaska, believe it or not, but it won't count because it's Lisa Murkowski and another Republican, so it'll be a Republican seat no matter what. And then Georgia, which goes to a runoff on December 6th. The only thing that boggles my mind is how people could even consider voting for Herschel Walker.
Well, a couple of things. One is I do think there's a significant difference between Lisa Murkowski and her opponent for a number of reasons, which is that assuming she wins, and it is highly likely she will because there's like 9,000 Democratic votes out or whatever, however, like, there's a huge chunk of Democratic votes out there, and most of those, we should assume, are going to be Murkowski second-round votes. Mm-hmm. And once they go to Murkowski, that'll, I think, easily put her over 50%. And Murkowski is far preferable because, among other things, she's pro-choice. And I think one of the more, like, we're not there yet. Like, it's likely that the Republicans are going to win House with, like, 3-seat majority, which is almost worse for them than anything else. And as you said, there's still the runoff with Warnock. But there were a number of people polled in Georgia who said the reason I'm voting for this black man who has had, we can't count any more abortions in his life, is because he makes a difference in the Senate. So those people, I think, may not turn out. I mean, Georgia's making it harder for Democratic voters to turn out as well. There may not be a Saturday day for early voting, but I think that there may be a significant fall off from Walker because he's such a crazy candidate. And my hope is, frankly, that over the next month, there's a lot of attention about what utter hypocrites evangelical voters are.
Oh, please.
Who are voting against a pastor for a man who violates the purported support, their anti-abortion views left and right. And so, I would love for those of us who aren't in Georgia and aren't knocking doors to really focus on the fact that evangelical voters are hypocrites. They have no moral stance to speak of when they choose Walker over Warnock.
It is astounding. I mean, you think about the people that they grew out of course, the moral majority. And here's the people who are embracing the pussy grabber, the domestic violence abuser and abortion benefactor.
Yeah, let's rebrand family values, because those Southern white evangelicals, they don't own that anymore, and they should not be allowed to claim. And frankly, I mean, Nicole, remember that the place where Trump really solidified the lead position in the primary in 2016 was in South Carolina, when a bunch of so-called evangelical voters voted for him over Ted Cruz. Let's use the next month to end the claim that white evangelicals, especially Southern white evangelicals, have on family values, on pro-life values, on morality. I mean,
Yes. And Reverend Barber has been trying to reclaim that territory. He started it years ago with his Moral Monday gatherings in North Carolina and has spread. They don't have a monopoly on morality, really. That's opposite world. All right. So we are at the tail end of this midterm election. The outcome is much better than the media led us to believe it was going to be. So that just shows you really can't trust polling. That's a story for another day. Let's get on to what's happening in the world of legal, of the Department of Justice and investigations into January 6th and the former president. So this morning, you posted an article at emptywheel.net. Merrick Garland hasn't done the specific thing you want because DOJ has been busy doing things they have to do first. You've been singing this song for many months months now. But obviously, I saw your tweet that I think predicated this article, because people are still screaming about Merrick Garland. You want to reiterate what you've been saying?
Yeah, and it's everyone. I mean, I just picked a fight with Andrew Weissman, who did the same thing. Oh, you've had 14 weeks since the raid, since the search of Mar-a-Lago. And it's like, when I first started seeing this Garland whinging again, it was literally hours after the most recent filing in the special master proceeding there in Florida. And we are still having a very active fight between Trump and DOJ over the documents that DOJ needs to prove their case against Trump. And I'll give you an example, because it's really fascinating. On Friday, DOJ filed something, and they said one of the documents, or one of the what they're treating as a document, one of the documents that we are fighting over is this 11-page document that was in a desk. They didn't say it was in a desk drawer, but we know it was in a desk drawer. It was in a desk drawer in Trump's office, and it consists of three messages, actually four, one that may involve a lawyer that they're having a separate fight over. But it consists of a message from a pollster, a message from a book author, a message from a religious leader, a confidential document, which is probably the most common documents classified confidential are State Department cables, and a secret document. And this packet is important, one, because it was found in a desk drawer. My guess is Trump's assistant, both at the White House and after he moved to Mar-a-Lago, is a woman named Molly Michael. Mm-hmm. And there's reason to believe that this was her desk. So there's reason to believe it was in her desk drawer. There were other documents, for example, that DOJ gave back that originally looked like they were meeting correspondence from the White House, but then everyone looked closely and they realized it was after Trump left the White House. So this is basically the desk that Molly Michael has used to run Trump's office in much the same way she did at the White House. That's my suspicion. So 11-page document from that desk. And those messages I just told you about, the pollster, the religious leader, and the book author, all of those post-date Trump's departure from the White House. The classified documents must come from when he was still in the White House.
Right.
So it's not the smoking gun, but this is the kind of mini smoking gun that prosecutors have been talking about from the start is, you know, what DOJ is doing is figuring out not just how classified these documents are, how they were used, but figuring out who accessed them and when. And since you have this packet of documents that mix post-January 2021 documents with classified documents that must have come from the White House, you got people actively using documents, classified documents that Trump stole from the White House while at Mar-a-Lago. This is evidence that Trump didn't just accidentally leave some top secret documents in the boxes he was sent into Mar-a-Lago. It's evidence that he brought these classified documents to Mar-a-Lago and then accessed them. My wild ass guess, and this is just that, one scenario where you could imagine a message from a pollster, book author, and a religious leader might come together is the 2000 mules conspiracy theory from Dinesh D'Souza. And so imagine if this was ongoing vote fraud efforts from Trump, you might see an intelligence document from the Italian conspiracy theory that they were chasing about election machines there. That's just a hypothesis. But the point, which is the really important point that matters to DOJ, is that this shows that Trump not only took these documents with him, but he continued to use them after he got to Mar-a-Lago and possibly may have exposed Molly Michael. She would have had, I assume, high-level clearance while at the White House, but none of these people were cleared after they left the White House. Uh-huh. And so that gets you into... then it's no longer a case where you're just proving that Trump brought documents home and refused to give some subset of them back after June 3rd. It's proof that he brought documents to Mar-a-Lago and used them and allowed somebody else who was not cleared to access them, access to them. And that makes it far easier to charge and prosecute against a former president. It shows that he stole the nation's secrets, brought them home, and used them for his own personal gain, or it's evidence to that fact. Remember that the FBI would have fingerprinted some of these documents, so they may know, for example, whether Molly Michael has accessed them or Trump or what have you. Now, the reason I spent all this time talking about that is because they're still fighting over legal access to them. Hmm. They are still enjoined by Judge Aileen Cannon's order from August. They are still enjoined, from September. The September 16th, this order would have been. But they are still prevented by law from using these unclassified documents as part of their investigation. So they may be very confident right now that, wow, this is part of a smoking gun, that Trump was using the classified documents for his own personal benefit. We've got these, but they can't present that to a grand jury because of that order until they win uncontested possession of these documents. And they have two ways of doing that. One is the special master process that Judge Deary will issue an order on December 16th about these fights. But once he does that, Trump is going to dispute the order, and then Judge Cannon is going to review it de novo. She has no deadline for herself. So we're really looking at mid-January before DOJ gets this, minor smoking gun accessible to present to a grand jury. The other route of getting this is that they appealed her order to the 11th Circuit. And the 11th Circuit, when they first reviewed it, was like, no question, DOJ wins. Trump submitted his filing on the 10th, so last week, and then on Friday, DOJ will submit its reply, and then sometime soon thereafter, the 11th Circuit could say there's no question it's DOJ's, but the other thing the most likely thing to happen is that the 11th Circuit is going to say, okay, let's have a hearing, and there will be a hearing on fairly short notice, November 24th or something, and then the 11th Circuit will issue a judgment. Trump will appeal to the Supreme Court. Given what they did the last time, the Supreme Court is unlikely to stay any, if as I suspect, the 11th Circuit rules for DOJ because they did the last time. So you're really looking at mid-December before DOJ can do anything with what we believe is a minor smoking gun that they were classified documents in a desk drawer in Trump's closet, in Trump's office, that were being actively used with post-White House activities. DOJ just can't do anything until December because if they do, the prosecution of Trump risks getting really held up on his evidentiary challenges. And so to make sure that that doesn't happen, you're going to see, unless something else, who knows? Maybe while we're speaking, DOJ is searching his Virginia golf course because they know that there are documents there. Mm-hmm. It would be far preferable if they found more classified documents in Virginia, in a better state, where they can charge it in Alexandria. But barring any unforeseen searches like that, the most likely process on the stolen documents case is that they gain full access to the documents, they issue an arrest warrant, they may search other areas, but they charge him, and they charge him not just for the crimes, there are several clauses of this part of the Espionage Act, that like what he was originally searched under, 18 U.S.C. 793E, is just basically him hoarding documents, him having classified documents, not storing them properly and refusing to give them back. But if, for example, DOJ develops proof that Boris Epstein conspired with him to refuse to give the documents back, and they have proof of that, then they can charge Epstein as well, along with Trump. And so they would charge, it changes, I think, the way in which you present this, and it changes it from just being Trump just being a document dispute, which is what Trump wants to claim it as, to Trump conspiring with people to keep classified documents to put them to his own personal use.
Right. Now there are a few other things that go hand in hand with this. One of them is Trump, the way he lies every time he breathes, he's saying, what's the big deal? Everyone else does this. The other presidents have taken documents. That's a blatant lie, isn't it?
Yeah. Basically, what has happened is other presidents have set up archives-run libraries or facilities in advance of their presidential libraries opening up, and the archives has taken already cataloged documents and transferred them from D.C. to cities where they are accessible. And for the most part, those don't include the kind of classified documents that they're fighting over. So it's a lie. But Trump, I mean, you know, one other thing that's going to happen that is already happening is that, you know, the Republicans realize that Trump, they lost Michigan's third, my congressional district, Yay. And they lost Washington's third after Trump took out somebody who voted for impeachment.
Yeah, huh? Washington, well, Jamie Herrera Butler's seat, she lost in the primary to a Republican. The Republican lost to the Democrat who won the nomination.
The same thing happened in Michigan's third, right? So Peter Meyer voted for impeachment. Trump took him out, replaced him with Gibbs, and Hillary Scolten. Now, that was already going to be a closer district because Grand Rapids has been trending bluer, mm-hmm. but it was a much easier race mm-hmm. for Scolten this year because this nut job, like the nut job in Washington, you know, Republican voters were going to vote against the nut job. And so those are two House seats that the Republicans didn't win because of Trump. And
That's
then
right.
Certainly at least Blake Masters in Arizona and Oz in
Pennsylvania,
those were Trump picks. That were not the best candidate for those states. And you know, if either one of those had gone Republican, the Republicans could be sitting in the Senate right now.
That's right.
But they're not. And they're not going to be. And if Herschel Walker loses, hopefully,
yes.
then that'll be a third Senate candidate that Trump basically picked. Who was too extreme for the state or who made it possible for Democrats to keep a Senate seat. And so Republicans, you know, they want to find a way to, or at least a big chunk of Republicans want to find a way to get past Donald Trump. And I mean, don't get me wrong. Trump has already made it clear he'll burn down the party. Like yep. he made it clear he was willing to burn down the country to stay in power. You know, you'll see the electoral equivalent of January 6th within the Republican Party, unless they can find some way to neutralize Trump. And one easy way to neutralize Trump is for him to be prosecuted.
Right.
And so I did a post yesterday. Andy, what is his name?
Andy, I have it right here. Andy McCarthy.
Andy McCarthy, who's a former federal prosecutor. He's a nut. He gets crazier and crazier the more years he gets away from prosecuting terrorists. But he is an important nut in the Republican activist sphere because they look to him to get a script to talk about legal issues. They look to him to find a way to spin their partisan loyalties in a way that he tells them to do. And so he's already been leaning in this way for a while, saying, well, Trump's going to be indicted. But he did a piece over the weekend where he basically said, I guarantee you Trump's going to be indicted. I mean, it was full of conspiracy theories, but that's why it'll work for Republican activists. You know, Democrats were going to prosecute Trump only to make him weak against Joe Biden
right.
and all of these, you know, it was crazy. But what he now says is, look, the prosecution of Trump for January 6th is reasonable. The prosecution of Trump for the stolen documents case totally makes sense. I mean, what choice did DOJ wow. have? Trump kept refusing to give the documents back. So at a time when, you know, before Republicans have been saying, oh, it's just a document dispute. How dare DOJ raid the former president? You're beginning to see a key voice on a key voice who basically scripts Republican activists saying, not only is Trump going to be indicted, but we should welcome it. It's a meritorious prosecution. And so I think you may see that from more Republicans. I mean, obviously, Trump partisans are not going to do that. There's a letter out today signed by Ginni Thomas and a bunch of other people saying, hold off on the leadership fights. They're using Herschel Walker as the excuse.
Right, and they're supposed to happen this week.
To find a way to ensure that a fire breather gets to be leader in both houses and possibly speaker in the House. But on that list, on that letter, were Mark Meadows, clearly a subject of the January 6th investigation, Jenna Ellis, clearly a subject of the fake electors investigation, and Cleta Mischel, also a subject of the fake electors investigation. So this is sort of a crime protection racket that the Clarence Thomas's spouse signed on to.
Yep.
But, you know, you're going to see, as you know, the leadership battle in Congress is partly a surrogate for the question of does the Republican Party accede to these prosecutions of Trump? Do they recognize them as meritorious? Or does the Republican Party, as it has done for years, double down on this crime racket, basically protecting people like Mark Meadows for attacking the country? And that's one of the dramas we'll see unfold over the next couple weeks.
Right. So already we're starting to see some cracks in the wall on the right, where a lot of blame has been leveled on Trump for the outcome of these midterms. And rightly so, I think. So it was tomorrow. We're supposed to be the House Republican leadership elections, and on Wednesday, the Senate. But as you said, there's this letter. They want to delay it because obviously it's not set yet. The votes aren't finished, and they want their Freedom Caucus people in. There's going to be a lot of battles over there,
I think.
In the meantime, as there are cracks over there, and some are starting to turn on Trump, he is reportedly doubling down and plans to go ahead with his event tomorrow, Tuesday, at Mar-a-Lago, in which he will ostensibly declare his candidacy for the presidency in 2024.
Yeah, and we'll see what happens. Like, I think that there are a lot of people who rightly warn that many Republicans and certainly the Republican base aren't ready to move on from Trump. I think that there are many Republicans who are grateful to use the failures of the election as the excuse to move on from Trump. I think that by announcing he's going to change his relationship with the party, Ron McDaniel has already said, we're not paying your legal bills anymore. We can't. And so I think that it also makes his fundraising legally more sanctionable. He's already in, like, his super PAC from the fundraising he did between the 2020 election and the insurrection, that's already under investigation by DOJ.
Good.
So, you know, what are the chances that Trump is actually going to be able to stay within the letter of the law once he announces he's running for president? Zero. I still don't know what's going to happen. You know, same thing I said about the election, but I think that there's a lot of tensions that people are not accounting for. And those tensions of, like, using the legal cases against Trump, using his status as a candidate to kind of separate themselves from Trump. I think those are all going to be in play. And the one leader on the Republican side who could manage that kind of challenge is Mitch McConnell. And people are trying to blame him instead of Trump. And it's hilarious. It's like, do you want to get rid of the best leader you have? Well, I'm sorry. Oh, don't twist my arm, right?
Yeah, it's pretty astounding. And it seems like Trump believes that by declaring his candidacy, he will avoid prosecution. But that's not the case.
Trump doesn't believe it. It's not that simple. Trump, and I hope to write this soon, but I don't know when I'll get it done. Trump has always succeeded by using his own victimization to demand loyalty from Republicans. He started with the Russian investigation. He moved on to the Ukrainian coercion. He moved on to January 6th. He's used January 6th then. He tried to use the document search. The stolen documents is the same. Now, there's polling that says the stolen document investigation didn't work as well to do that. It also, by the way, he doesn't have pardon power. And right. So, you know, he wouldn't have been able anyway, but he wasn't able to keep Kash Patel from testifying before a grand jury. And that was a key that he used to dodge legal accountability for years. I don't think Trump believes this will prevent him from being charged. I think Trump believes that if he is charged while he is running, it will make it easier for him to attack the investigation.
Sure.
It will make it easier for him to demand loyalty because he is being investigated. And he may be wrong this time for the reasons I've already laid out. He may be wrong because there are enough Republicans who don't need to do that this time around.
Gotcha. That's interesting. Marcy Wheeler is with us for another in-depth look at what's going on. So we were all, you know, focused on the elections and not, except you, not paying so much attention to the ongoing court cases that were going on. In fact, the last time we spoke, they were the trial for Deripaska. Who was it that was still?
Deripaska.
Okay. So that was found again against.
Acquittal.
I'm sorry? Acquittal.
Yeah, he was acquitted.
So Trump has a flawless record there. He's being defeated basically every time they go to court. Now, there are other cases still in the works, right? The Proud Boys and Oath Keepers. Isn't there a trial still in progress?
The Oath Keeper case is still in progress, and it'll remain in the evidentiary stage, presenting witnesses until through this week, I think. And then we'll see how long it takes them to deliberate. So that's the first five of the Oath Keepers. Shortly after, there will be a second one of the Oath Keepers charged with sedition. The Proud Boys case is more interesting as we speak, and we're taping earlier on Monday.
Right. Or taping Monday morning. Yes.
But as we speak, there's a hearing because the Proud Boys claim that they just got notice about a bunch of informants into the Proud Boys who said they didn't know anything about an attack on the Capitol, and that not just that this evidence rules against their prosecution, but they're arguing that DOJ should have turned this over months ago as Brady material. So there's a closed door hearing literally as we are taping this for that challenge, and we'll see what DOJ has to say. I mean, the claim that this should have been Brady material is coming from the defense attorneys, and you know, you should normally agree with defense attorneys when they make such claims, but in this case, certainly the loudest of the ones making this claim has been crying about this all along, and it, you know, it's kind of a boy cried wolf. He's made claims and they've never held up, so we'll see whether this one does. But the Proud Boy case is not as easy as the Oath Keeper case for a variety of reasons I've written about, but so we'll see what happens with that.
Okay. So tomorrow the new book from Mike Pence will be released. You wrote about this quite a bit, and you mentioned that the Wall Street Journal published an excerpt that relates to January 6th. And basically, you said that the things that he reveals, this conversations with Trump, would have been covered by executive privilege. And these are things that he refused to comment on in the past. But now that the book's coming out, in a tweet, it's there.
He didn't really tweet it out. Okay. He published a book, but I first read about it on Twitter.
Gotcha.
With the Wall Street Journal excerpt, and it's like he just tweeted it out.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, we have had literally a year of privilege fights over precisely this material, and he just tweeted it out, or Wall Street Journal tweeted it out for him. These are, and this is, you know, for the people who are complaining that Garland hasn't been doing anything, he has. He got the testimony of Greg Jacob, who was Pence's counsel and of Mark Short, who was Pence's chief of staff. And maybe, although I haven't seen confirmation of the two Pats, Pat Cipollone and Pat Philbin, and all four of them had invoked executive privilege in early grand jury appearances. And certainly the Pence guys have had to go back and testify for hours about the things that Trump said to Pence, about the meetings they were in, about the scam to overturn the election, about Trump's awareness that the scam was illegal and John Eastman's awareness that the scam was illegal. And so now I said two things. One about Pence's book, there are aspects of it, including about a January 4th meeting, which is really critical because at the meeting, Pence turned to John Eastman and said, "This is BS." And John Eastman said, "Well, you know, no court has ruled against us yet." And Pence, as he described it in the book, turned to Trump and said, "Your lawyer doesn't even believe this stuff." As Trump, as Pence tells it in the book, it was limited to one of two theories about how they were going to steal the election. And as Pence describes, Trump gave a response. The short version of it is, as told, it provides a glimmer of defense for Trump, like that he believed that part of it was illegal, but not the other part. Or it provides a way for Pence to say that his testimony isn't critical in the way that Greg Jacob or Mark Short's is. But, you know, if I'm DOJ and he has published this book about his interactions with Trump, and some of these interactions, and I wrote a list in the post I did on it, a number of these interactions appear to be exclusively through him and Trump. We know from January 6th committee testimony that his aides would leave the room if there were a conversation between him and Trump. And so for some of these conversations, for example, there was a phone call that Trump put to Pence around 11 a.m. on January 6th. And the January 6th committee was able to get, you know, maybe four witnesses to Trump's side of that conversation. We know, for example, that Trump called Pence a pussy because Ivanka's chief of staff witnessed it, or Ivanka came back from the meeting and shared the information with her chief of staff. But we don't know Pence's side. Mm-hmm. And so this is something, so I guess long and short, is DOJ going to ask Pence to testify to a grand jury? They should, and they have reason to, and he would have a hard time invoking executive privilege because he just wrote a book about it.
Right.
But the other thing about this is these are really high-level direct witnesses to stuff to Trump's mens rea, to Trump, what Trump knew and did, and his knowledge that his scheme to steal the election was illegal. These people, three of them lawyers, have been trying to withhold or have succeeded in withholding this testimony so far, but DOJ has gotten at least half of it in the last month or so. And the stuff relating to Pence is the stuff, in my estimation, I obviously don't know what's going on inside DOJ, but that's the stuff where DOJ is closest to making the case against Trump. And we'll see what they do with that.
Gotcha. So there's DOJ, and the January 6th committee is still working. Again, the Democrats haven't lost the House. I'm knocking on wood laminate that there's still a slight chance they can keep it, but it's looking more and more like it's going to go to the Republicans with a very, very slight, maybe the closest margin we've ever seen in the House. And if they do take control and there's a Republican speaker, obviously the January 6th committee is dissolved and then they start investigations. But I believe today was the day Trump was supposed to testify in a deposition before the January 6th committee. And over the weekend, his lawyers filed a 40-page lawsuit. Delay that. He's just going to try to run out the clock, isn't he?
He is, but I would caution about assuming that the subpoena was for naught altogether. Mm-hmm. For the same reason that Steve Bannon was prosecuted for contempt. Mm-hmm. And the reason being, and I haven't written this up, so I don't have all the details right off the tip of my head, but the reason being is that the January 6th committee asked for a number of things. They asked one of the things in to my mind that they were most interested in was his Signal conversations with a variety of conspirators. And that's interesting that the president of the United States would be plotting an insurrection over Signal.
Yes.
And, you know, some of these would be, we know from the Mueller investigation that he would use other people's phones. Mm-hmm. So, for example, DOJ used a warrant to get the phone of, Boris Epstein, and there's another guy who was one of these. Can I say that F word here?
You can say anything here. Yes.
Yeah. So it's another rat fucker, and his name escapes me right now. But anyway, so they got these two phones, and those are the kinds of phones that would have Signal texts that reflect Trump's involvement. And that's likely one of the things that that DOJ is after with that. But one of the questions that, you know, as they were debating back and forth with Trump's lawyers, DOJ said, you know, or sorry, January 6th committee said, we just want to know which phones you used.
Ooh.
And that's not privileged,
right?
That's, you know, that's not at all privileged. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there were some tactical way to give him exposure on a contempt charge. That's not going to put the president in jail, but it will discomfort him for a while in a way that will be interesting. And plus, I mean, you know, I already talked about there are going to be Republicans who want to say, oh, gosh, Trump is terrible. This whatever else this report is. And unfortunately, there was a report from NBC over the weekend that it's not going to include a lot on the FBI failures. It's not going to include a lot on the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers. And to my mind, one of the most important things that needs some scrutiny is how the FBI came to treat the Proud Boys as partners rather than as terrorists.
Wow.
And that is the most damning question outside of Trump's culpability.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be left on the editing floor.
Although the committee is pushing back on that report, as you would expect, I guess, but they are.
Yeah. I mean, let's see what happens. And obviously people leaked it to make sure that there would be pressure on the committee to do it all.
Uh-huh.
That's how DC works. But importantly, if you get a report that says, here's all the bad things Trump did, and Republicans are looking for a way to distance themselves from Trump, and if somebody wants to kneecap Jim Jordan,
yep,
right, this is a way embracing this report, or at least accepting this report and saying, oh, my gosh, you know, we had no idea what a bad man Trump was. We really want to put, you know, and it's right. All a play. Like, this is not good faith. But nevertheless, you know, aside from accountability for people like Jim Jordan, nevertheless, you know, it's something that Democrats should welcome to the extent that Republicans choose to return to the means of democracy rather than political violence. And, you know, I'm happy to allow them to do that, even if it's in bad faith, so long as we continue to hold people like Jim Jordan accountable and so long as we continue to have scrutiny on DeSantis.
Right. Now, you mentioned DeSantis. All right. I got to go there because, you know, I'm in Florida. I'm leaving Florida, but I'm still in Florida. This state was the outlier in this election, though it came first in the returns because Florida is good at counting votes fast. But there's a disconcerting energy going on out there. And actually, it hit me when I saw Ali Velshi on MSNBC this weekend, who I usually think of as one of the better ones. There's better and worse. I usually think he's better, except he was positioning it as, well, some of the Republicans are now, you know, eschewing Trump and, you know, they're more toward leaning towards DeSantis. As if DeSantis was a reasonable choice. DeSantis is every bit the fascist Trump is. He's just Trump with a little more education and a bit smarter, but yeah, less,
I mean,
of the charisma.
He's better at governance. He's far less charismatic.
Yes.
You know, if they want to take each other out, I'm perfectly happy.
Like,
you know,
too.
If Trump wants to burn down the Republican Party in a fight, in an inter-Florida fight with Ron DeSantis, he'll be out of the state by then, Nicole.
Oh, without a doubt. But I don't want the so-called, you know, liberal media, whatever is left of it, to position DeSantis as the saner choice between the two, because he is not. He's by no means sane, or would he be a reasonable Republican? He is not a John Kasich or a John McCain. He is in the Trump world. Just I need to make that clear.
Yeah,
without a doubt. Okay. One thing we haven't talked about is, since we last spoke, the complete...
Wait, can I go back, Nicole?
Please. Oh, go back. Yes.
Oh, remember, Trump is trying to threaten DeSantis against running.
Oh, yeah.
And he went on this rant on his failing social media platform the other day. And he said, yeah, you know, I brought the FBI and DOJ out to stop counting votes in 2018.
Yeah.
That's not true. But never, you know, everything Trump says is not true. So, but most things Trump says are based in some nugget of reality.
Right.
And I think that if things go nuclear between Trump and DeSantis, things could get very interesting because, for example, we know that the January 6th, the DOJ January 6th investigation is investigating the 2018 Stop the Steal effort in Florida, which was another Roger Stone special. It was done by Roger Stone's deputy, Jacob Engels, who's Proud Boys, who has been involved in this rat fuckery forever. And DOJ is saying, you know, to what degree is the model that was used in 2016 the same one used in 2018? The insurrection model from 2020, what was used in 2018. And oh, by the way, DOJ already has that investigated from 2016. And that gets exactly to the relationship between Donald Trump, Roger Stone, and Ron DeSantis. And so while it is not true that Trump sent the FBI to help shut down the vote in Broward County.
Hello. Yes.
It is true that there was rat fuckery there that DOJ is already investigating. And, you know, I'm not sure. I think that what Trump was trying to do was to say, I know where your bodies are buried,
yep,
Ron DeSantis. And in fact of the matter, those bodies are common. They all go through Roger Stone.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, if they go full nuclear in Florida and Trump really doesn't care about burning things down, if he can't have it, he'll make sure you can't have it either.
Right.
And so I don't rule out us learning interesting things about Ron DeSantis from that conflict. Yeah,
cool. Bring it on. I say bring it on. I just don't want America to get the idea that Ron DeSantis is a reasonable alternative to Donald Trump. He's as batshit crazy, just in a slightly different way. So, Marcy Wheeler, one last thing for you. Since the last time we spoke, Twitter has imploded, or, well, Elon Musk blew $44 billion to buy and trash Twitter. what do you see as the future of that platform?
Yeah, I think people should get the app off their phone. And I think people should download their Twitter content and possibly destroy their DMs, because it may not last a week. And it's, you know, like that it like there are two things that are like, and this is the same thing that involves Trump, right? It's another billionaire narcissist,
yep,
who is burning down the world because it's not the way, because he's not loved enough. And for Musk, it's the same thing. It's like, I'm not loved enough, and so I'm going to burn down the people who don't love me. Was it his plan all along to destroy this platform that has been used to bring down fascist dictators? I don't know. I think that he's too unreliable right now to believe that he went out with a plan and is implementing a plan. He's got these advisors who don't know what they're doing around him. And so they may have their plans, and Musk may have his egotistical damage that he's trying to fix by blowing $44 billion. And maybe it's part of a fascist plot. Maybe he thought he could turn it around and he just wouldn't listen to the pinheads. We don't know. But where we're at right now is because Musk got his ass handed to him in this deal, because he overpaid for it so badly without doing any due diligence, and because he didn't have enough money. I mean, so his money is Tesla.
Right.
And since he announced he was going to buy Twitter, Tesla's value has gone down dramatically, which means his value has gone down dramatically. And he, so he's not liquid. So he had to take out this debt, and the debt is completely unsustainable for Twitter. So he is going to try and monetize everything that moves at Twitter and degrade the experience for everyone who doesn't pay.
Aye.
And that's bad enough. Like I've seen since he's taken over, my kind of response threads have gotten so much overrun with trolls and stupid people.
Really?
And they're just much less quality than they used to be. But the other thing that's going to go on, and this is why I say people should take it off their phone, is that Musk has basically gutted the security and the privacy functions and the engineering functions at Twitter. So the things that make it safe for you to use the platform, the things that keep the platform working where you are all going to start crumbling.
Wow.
Today, yesterday.
Wow.
Musk made an announcement yesterday. He's like, oh, sorry, it's slow. And some parts of the world we're trying to fix, like, he's fighting the people who keep the thing running from day to day. And so it's going to stop running and it's going to stop being secure. And so people should imagine themselves being in kind of a digital crime-ridden nightclub while they're on Twitter.
Oh, my God.
Right? Yeah. So it's dark. You don't know who's there. There are pickpockets.
There are people who want to put stuff in your drink, right?
Yeah. I mean, yes. Somebody's the digital equivalent of spiking your drink and then taking your DMs or what have you. That's the kind of risk that I think people face on Twitter going forward, because he has not kept the security and the actual functioning up. I've moved to Mastodon.
I'm on Mastodon.
Some other places. I've heard rumors that there's going to be a replacement coming that is ethical. Mastodon's been a really interesting place. It's like we're all children again. It's like we're adolescents. We're going on Mastodon and we're making new friends and we're trying to figure out how things work. And so, I'm enjoying my time at Mastodon. It comes at an awkward time because to follow the election, you really still need to be on Twitter.
Right.
But it's going to go under. I mean, I don't see any way that it doesn't go under.
Wow. And then the snowball effect with what happens with Musk and Tesla and everything else will be interesting to watch, but better to watch from the sidelines, I guess, than be on
better
Twitter.
Better to watch having ensured that you're secure.
Yes. Yeah. Got it. Marcy Wheeler, anything I didn't ask you about that's on your radar that we should know about?
Not that it wouldn't take another hour. So we'll get there and we'll come back soon.
Definitely. Marcy Wheeler, you're just the best. Thank you so much. Find Marcy at emptywheel.net. Still on the Twitters at emptywheel for now. And on Mastodon at emptywheel. You are at mastodon.social or where?
Mastodon.social.
Okay. So I'll link to you. I'll put it on my blog where I put today's show so people can find you. I'm still learning my way around there. I'm completely lost and don't really have time to do
all the
exploring.
I don't have time either. Like if I had 2 weeks to just figure out how it worked, it'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I tried to connect with a lot of people. So when people move over following me, they can connect to other people but it's going to come slowly, but it's better for, I think, people to find a home and decide that they don't need it if by some miracle Twitter is saved, than to be left with no way to build those connections.
Right. Gotcha. Marcy Wheeler, thank you again, and stay safe over there in Ireland. I was thinking I may have to join you there, but we may have a bit of a respite here. So, okay. Until next time, as always, thank you.
Always good to be on. Thanks, Nicole.
Marcy Wheeler, there she goes. Emptywheel.net is with the website where she does all her reporting. You should definitely have that. Oh, hold on. Whoops. It would help. I'm talking and my mic wasn't on. Marcy Wheeler. Sorry, video people. Emptywheel.net is where you find her. You should be there. You should go there every day. And because that's where all her reporting
is written up, and it's just an a great site. Lots of information there. And of course, still on the Twitters for now at Empty Wheel. All right, that's it. We're done for today. So tomorrow we'll be back. Sarah Posner is going to join us tomorrow to talk about the attacks by the right on the trans people of this world. There's a lot there that we're not told about, but stuff you need to know. All right. Until tomorrow, thanks for listening, everybody. All right, I will leave you with the news because we can do that around here. Okay, bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Congress is back. Welcome to the lame duck session, and it looks to be a busy one. Government funding is the most important unfinished priority as the lawmakers face a December 16th deadline. The defense authorization bill, Ukraine aid, same-sex marriage, electoral college reform, and dealing with a debt limit all will be debated over the closing weeks of the 117th Congress. All the more reason why I'm still angry that my former representative here in Florida's 23rd District, Ted Deutsch, abandoned his post before the end of the term to start work on his new job. I think that's reprehensible when the margin is so slight. It was a nail-biter of a weekend as vote counts trickled in. On Saturday night, with the Senate race in Nevada called for the incumbent Democrat Catherine Cortez Masto, the Democrats once again secured control of the Senate. There are actually two races left to be decided. In Georgia, incumbent Democrat Raphael Warnock and Herschel Walker head to a runoff on December 6th. A Warnock victory would make the count 51-49, helping to make the obstructive Manchinima duo a little less relevant. And counting also continues in Alaska, although the final two candidates, incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski and challenger Kelly Chewbacca, are both Republicans. Attention now turns to the House, where, as of early Monday morning, Republicans have secured 212 seats, Democrats 204, though those numbers vary depending on which news outlet you're quoting. What doesn't change is the number 218. That's what's needed for a majority. Republicans are still favored to win, but the possibility of the Democrats pulling it out are not impossible. Most of the races still to be called are in California. And we're still awaiting the call on the Arizona governor's race, where, with 98% of the vote in, the Democrat, Katie Hobbs, remains in the lead with 50.5% to Republican Carrie Lake's 49.5%. Only 26,011 votes out of a total of 2,297,279 votes counted so far, separating them. Stay tuned. A lot of history was made in this election, including this. For the first time since 1934, the party in control of the White House retained all of its state legislative majorities in a midterm election and will likely even be the first to add a governor's seat or two. And one of my favorite outcomes of this cycle, in Washington's 3rd congressional district, the Democrat Marie Glusenkamp Perez beat the Republican Joe Kent 50.5% to 49%. This after the defeat in the primary by Joe Kent of incumbent Jamie Herrera Butler. She was one of the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Trump. Republicans have held this seat since 2011, but voters opted for the Democrat over the Republican who ousted Jamie Herrera Butler. In non-election news, the campus of the University of Virginia and all of Charlottesville is in lockdown Monday morning after a gunman killed three people and wounded two others in a garage on the school's main campus. UVA police were searching for a suspect they've identified as a student, Christopher Darnell Jones Jr., who's listed on the university's athletic website as a football player in 2018. I'm only giving his name because the man is still on the loose and is considered armed and dangerous. Classes today have been canceled. In a related story, a memorial to the 20 first graders and six educators killed in the Sandy Hook school shooting 10 years ago next month officially opened on Sunday in Newtown, Connecticut. The five-acre site includes a path from the small parking lot leading down a hill to a water feature with a sycamore tree on an island. The names of the 26 who were killed are engraved on a stone wall supporting the pool.
The old school was torn down, but the new one is visible from the memorial. Well, the former guy is reportedly in meltdown mode after much of the blame for his party's huge losses in the midterms are landing right at his feet. On top of that, the New York Times is reporting that while in office, Trump repeatedly told John Kelly, his then chief of staff, that he wanted a number of his perceived political enemies to be investigated by the IRS. Kelly was chief of staff from July of 2017 through the end of 2018, and he said in response to questions from the New York Times that Trump's demands were part of a broader pattern of him trying to use the Justice Department and his authority as president against people who had been critical of him, including seeking to revoke the security clearances of top former intelligence officials. Kelly said that among those Trump said, quote, we ought to investigate and get the IRS on, were former FBI Director James Comey and his deputy Andrew McCabe, and indeed both of them were subject to highly invasive IRS audits after Kelly's departure. Also, today is the day that Donald Trump was to appear for a deposition by the 1-6 committee. Instead, his attorneys filed another lawsuit to avoid cooperating. And in a sign of hubris or just plain delusion, reports say that the former president will continue with his planned announcement Tuesday from Mar-a-Lago in Florida. He has previously hinted that he would launch a 2024 presidential campaign during that event. Well, the Biden administration is no longer accepting applications for student loan forgiveness after a second federal court shut down the program. About 26 million people have already applied out of an estimated 40 million who qualify, and 16 million applications had already been approved. But none of the relief has gone out because of these court rulings. The issue is likely to end up in front of the Supreme Court. Turning to Ukraine. Since the Russian invasion back in February, Kherson was the only regional capital they'd been able to capture. Well, Russian forces have withdrawn. And on Sunday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that the Russians committed war crimes before they fled the city last week. In fact, investigators have already documented more than 400 Russian war crimes. Bodies of dead civilians and servicemen have been found. Ukrainian forces swept into the city over the weekend and were greeted by cheering residents. Most homes there remain without power and water service, but utility companies in the region were working on restoring electricity and other infrastructure damaged or mined by the retreating Russian troops. Meanwhile, President Zelensky went to liberated Kherson today and attended the restoration of the Ukrainian flag. President Biden this morning met with Chinese leader Xi Jinping for the first in-person encounter since he took office. The U.S. and China disagree with each other on just about every major issue, from Taiwan to the war in Ukraine to North Korea to technology to just about everything. According to a U.S. official, the main objective of this meeting was not about reaching agreements, but about gaining a better understanding of each other's priorities. Okay. Among the many problems Elon Musk is now facing is one brewing over his compensation package as the CEO of Tesla. It's the largest for anyone on Earth from a publicly traded company. So he's headed to court this week to defend his huge pay package as questions continue to mount. Meanwhile, Elon Musk also faces another busy week as the new owner of Twitter, where a lot of chaos has brought one of the world's most influential social networks close to the brink. The future of Twitter does really hang in the balance. And that's just a bit of what's news. For now, I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.